Real quick before we start the show, just wanted to let you guys know you can get the show 2 days early by joining our Patreon. Even for a buck, you can listen to the show 2 days early. Go to patreon.com/analogtalk and we got a bunch of stuff over there. Check it out and enjoy the episode.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk. I'm your host, Chris.
I'm Tim.
And today's special guest, we have Dan Rubin. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you're like a bucket list guest for us, so we're super excited to chat with you. But before we get into all that, can you give our listeners a background in yourself and who you are and how you got started and all that stuff?
Oh, gosh. We only have an hour, right?
Yeah.
So I'm only half joking with that answer. I'm a designer and photographer and a budding film director, among other things. I got my start as a creative, I think, as a professional creative in my mid-teens as a designer, which is a lot earlier than a lot of people would start. But I got my start as a photographer a lot later than a lot of people would start. I think I was about 30 when I finally made a connection with a camera as a creative tool. So we can dive into the details of that because it is that's a fun story, but it can run away with itself. But so essentially, I've been a some sort of creative or you know borderline artist for my entire life, doing oils and watercolors when I was in my early teens, like 12, 13 years old, and playing around with Lego bricks earlier than that and model airplanes and things. So I was always doing something that was creative output and that was always some sort of hybrid of either design or engineering or art, but always on that creative end. And photography kind of took over as a hobby and a way to get away from computer screens. Initially, it was like this thing that I discovered. And I went, oh my gosh, like, what is this? Why have I not looked at a camera like this before? I'd had cameras before, disposables or whatever. I'd never seen them as creative tools, even though I had one of my girlfriends in my late teens, early 20s. She was a fantastic, phenomenal photographer, and she studied photography, and yet it never occurred to me to try myself. Right? It was just it was one of those things other people were good at, and I think a lot of people have that actually. If you're never in a position to get directly encouraged to try something, to seriously try something, or if someone doesn't suggest to you, hey, you might like this, you might enjoy this, it's very easy to kind of look at it from the outside, even if you're really close to it, even if you're right outside that window, and not think that it's for you. So, and I've always been someone who's tried to coach and teach other people to not fall into that trap or just to kind of push people past the edge. But I very rarely have people to do that for me. And it just shows how natural a human behavior it is. So anyway, finding photography and was something that was literally life changing. And I'm still a designer. Wow. As I said, I'm getting into filmmaking kind of slowly, and I'm self taught in all of these things, which just means constantly studying and looking and learning and iterating. So yeah, that's me as much of a nutshell as I can give. We can go on all the tangents you want.
Man, so that's funny. I love the like how everything collides like with other people's stories. I think I just said this in the last episode we have, but same with me. Like I was in my 30s when I, fell in love with a camera all over again and realized that because I also did design. I went to school for design I didn't realize that before that I would take like other people's images and manipulate them. And then I was like, oh wait, that's like a copyright thing. You can't really do that. So that's kind of how I got into making my own photos to manipulate and do so. I love how people's worlds collide kind of story wise. So you said the 30s. Was this during film or is this like the digital time of photography when you broke in?
Well, it was. Digital had already become a thing by that point, but it wasn't a thing for me. I was working a lot with photography in my design work, and a lot of the design work was digital. I'd started out in print, but I was an early adopter of digital and doing work as a designer online. So photography was something I loved working with, and I would work with other photographers as well for certain clients, not just stock photography. And I love photography as an element, as a visual element. I'd been working with photographers who were shooting digital, more than shooting film, I think. But I'd never seen them as tools. So it's actually, in a weird way, it's a combination of my passion for product design, for physical product design, and a fear of missing out that led me to photography. Yeah. And even though I was firmly, when I discovered it, it was because I guess it was about 12 years ago. 2007 or 8, it would have been. So 12, 13 years ago now. And I would have just turned 30, I think. And a couple of designers that I knew, who I knew through the work that I did in the web, they had bought and were shooting a lot of Polaroid. They bought SX70s, the wonderful, lovely original folding models. Oh, yeah. And I just thought, I'd never seen one of those before. And because you don't casually come across those if you're not into any kind of photography at all.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, you might see it in a design museum somewhere, but I just, for whatever reason, I'd never seen one. And I saw this thing and I just thought, they were shooting them because Polaroid had announced they were discontinuing their film. So, and that was, that happened in 2006. And then, so the film was still available. You could still buy it at a Walgreens, right? But they weren't manufacturing anymore. And so these two designers I knew had bought the cameras and were just shooting it to be able to experience it before it went away forever. So that's where the fear of missing out came from. I saw this camera and I thought, oh my gosh, that's one of the most beautiful products I've ever seen. I would love to have that on my shelf. And I also want to buy a couple of packs of this film and shoot it before it goes away. And literally that's all I did. I bought two packs. I found a camera in essentially mint condition on eBay. It was probably about $50. It was,
Just going to say, what was the price?
The good old days.
The good old days.
Yeah, no one wanted these things. And the one I found was, I'm pretty sure it came in a box and it had been sitting. It was the woman who was selling it had found it in her mother's closet. And it had been sitting in her mother's closet for 25, 30 years. So it had barely been used. And I bought two packs of film and started shooting it. And I was still living in Florida at that time, which is where I'm stuck thanks to the pandemic travel restrictions right now. But I've been based in the UK for 10 years. I was living in Fort Lauderdale. I wasn't a photographer at all. I just like took some pictures around my apartment and around the neighborhood. And they were all, like almost all of them were beautiful, and they were and that was the first time I'd had that kind of relationship and that with an image that I'd created. And it's also tied into the immediacy of taking and then only waiting a few minutes and seeing the result in a different way than digital's immediacy, where you're not actually seeing an edited result. You've got to put so much time in that, which is, I think now in hindsight, why I'd never connected with any of the little digital cameras that I'd picked up. They were point and shoots, but I'd never really loved the results. So it didn't encourage me to play more. And then suddenly I was shooting these Polaroids and I just loved them. And literally my world changed immediately because my designer brain suddenly needed to reverse engineer why this camera and these little white bordered sheets of film were making me react that way, because I knew I hadn't changed. And as a designer, I was constantly looking at, especially with interaction design, constantly looking at user behavior and how you can influence it through your design. So I knew that it was something to do with a combination of the film and the camera that had worked better for me. And so I went out and almost immediately bought a Canon digital SLR, kind of an APS-C DSLR, and started playing with that because I thought, ooh, maybe it's an SLR that's the difference, because the SX70 is. And that was better with the Nifty 50 51.8, but it still wasn't as good. So then I went and got a 35mm Canon, it was an old an FTB that an ex-girlfriend's dad gave me by chance, kind of, but it was just at the right timing. So now I had this kind of 3 points of comparison, this instant camera that didn't have a lot of control, this modern digital camera that had a lot of control, but I didn't like the results as much from, and then this camera that was slightly older than I was, as a 35mm SLR, that suddenly it had fully manual controls, but I loved the results of it. And that's very early on, I realized that film was something special, and that the amount of work required to make a digital image feel as good as a film scan or an instant image could feel right away was something that I probably wasn't as into, even though I threw myself at digital photography for years. When I got into shooting any kind of commercial work, it was entirely digital. because I kind of thought that's what was needed. And I was constantly iterating, buying tons of cameras on the film side, especially. My main digital camera was a 5D Mark II to begin with, so it was I had good equipment and it was giving me good results, but I was spending loads of time on post. And then I got into shooting the Sonys for a few years, but all throughout I was building and building and building my experience on the film side. And so it's been this really weird winding road for the last 12, 13 years. And the result has been that I now almost never shoot digital. The last 3-4 years have been primarily film for everything. I shoot digital. Well, I view them as different, totally different tools. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why there are so many fights between the camps, one side or the other, is that they're seen as much more similar than they actually are. The similarities end at the point where, well, almost even before you take the picture, because so much of the creative process with film is deciding what film stock you're going to shoot and how you're going to shoot it, how you're going to expose it, whether you're going to pull or push it, and understanding you're doing a lot of pre-visualization.
Yeah.
And so even before you get to taking the pictures, the process is so different that they're almost not the same thing. They just share a name. And I still use, I have lots of things with me, right? But like I travel with my Leica Q all the time now, which is almost the least capable digital camera that I've owned, but as one thing that will always easily fit in any bag, and that if I need what digital is best at, which for me is low light, if I need that, the Q does the trick. It guarantees me really good images, and I can work with a 28 mil lens just fine. Like if I'm in a position where I go, crap, I really need something either right away or in the dark, that'll do it. And that's what I loved the A7 S and S2 and the R and R2 for a while, but they were just so they were too much for that, for being the extra just in case camera. And I mean, the Q is total overkill as well, especially price wise. I mean, it's a very but I only got it because of a project, and it was that I did, and my first book that I co-shot and co-designed with a friend in Japan happened to be shot while I was loaning or borrowing the Q for a month from Leica, and I took it to Japan, and then I shot my book on it, and I went, oh crap, I have to keep this because now I've made my first book with it. So very luckily Leica UK sold it to me because it was a used item. I said, I want this one, I don't want another one, I want the one that I made the book on. They did me a deal on it. Otherwise it's such overkill. But the rest of me is all film for so many different reasons. I mean, I've got well over 50 different cameras at this point, all from
that's 8 by 10.
I know. I'm way behind. I've managed to sell probably 4 or 5 over the last 3 or 4 years, which was difficult to do. And I still have too many, right? But that includes 4x5 cameras and one 8x10 and a bunch, probably 12 different models of SX70 and SLR680, because I'm addicted to those. Mm-hmm. So the cross section in the middle of medium format and 35 mil is actually not, it's not insane. It's still way more than any human needs, but I like to use all of them in rotation, but really when I buy a camera, it's for the same reason that I was attracted to the SX70 in the first place. It's because I see some camera's design. I see the industrial design, and if I get curious about it, about, okay, why did they make that decision? Why is that camera so popular? I have to shoot it and hold it for myself as kind of a research project. Mm-hmm. And the cameras that I don't connect with during that first test roll, those I sell on. But the reason I have over 50 now is because I've connected with so many of them.
Yeah.
And they're just... They're as much as I do, they're wonderful objects. So yeah.
I was having a conversation. I'm itching to buy a new toy, so I'm like between like a Contax T2 and like a Leica M4. Mm. We were having this discussion, and it was like, well, the Contax could break. I'm like, I know, but it's so nice. It's like I want it more because it's a nice, solid, beautiful. Even if I don't shoot it, I'll just have it. I know.
I have a T2, and embarrassingly, I have two T2s, one of which I'll sell. But well, so there's a rule that I have for cameras.
Name
that,
your and, price. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, but there's a rule. Once I started shooting film for projects for clients, I already had a rule with digital that I, because when I bought my 5D Mark II, I still had my original APS-C, which was an XTI, the Rebel 400, I think, or 400D, something like that. It was the Rebel XTI as my Canon. And that always went with me on any, once there started to be client shoots, the XTI was my backup camera. Because I brought backup CF cards back then, and I just felt it was responsible to do that with digital anything. I didn't want to be on a shoot and have my camera die and not be able to complete the work. And I've always kind of felt very much like that. I've been very serious about backups as a digital designer as well. And so once I started taking film cameras, well, I would take a film camera along initially and just shoot on occasional gigs to see how I liked the results. And that was very, very quickly once I started doing that, I went, oh, I should just do this all the time because I like them better and it's less work. And then when I started taking film cameras with me on projects, I applied the same rule. I had to have if it was something I used for client work, I had to buy a second one. And even more so almost because these were a lot of older cameras. So when they've cycled out of being cameras that I use professionally, then I sell them on. So I had two Hasselblad 500 CMs, but only because I was using them for a little while on client projects. And then I stopped and I was like, all right, there's no reason for me to have two of these. And I sold one to a friend. And so I have two T2s now. One of them needs to be sold, honestly, because I was using them as my, I was using them as my pocket camera for incidental shots on travel projects. Mm-hmm. So, and there's something, I got one at a song years ago, probably 5 or 6 years ago, and was immediately impressed by the results. So went, okay, I have to start taking this on shoots. Yeah. And so that was my rule. I found another one at a good deal. And between the two of them, I think I spent less than they were going for individually. So that's how I justified it as well. I'm very patient. That's the thing. You have to be with these crazy rises and falls in pricing of film cameras now because of all this resurgence. It's popularity, and they get expensive for a while, and then something else
dropping.
Gets.
Yeah.
But everything does in cycles, right? I was recommending point and shoot 35mm point and shoots to a friend in Europe. In Austria, and I kind of recommended the gamut. They'd been told about the T2, and I said, okay, yeah, good, but they're way overpriced right now. So here, look at the Fuji Class, because those are undervalued by comparison. They're still expensive, but they're so good, and they're so much cheaper than a lot of the others. And then the Fuji Tiara, those are great as well. And if you really want something that's designed well, but also takes good pictures. And then he took all that information and then sent me a couple of eBay links and said, well, what about these? And he was finding T2s in Austria for like half what they're costing in these. So maybe they're on a dip again. And it just shows that none of this is stable. And it's the same with all of these. If you're patient enough, you can find a deal. And every single camera that I've purchased of the too many that I have has been for so much less than anyone thinks that it should have cost, because I'm not in a hurry to spend a lot of money. That's it, really. I'm a penny pincher. I know the value of things, but I don't want to pay more than it's worth.
Right.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway,
I was almost like refusing to pay. Like I was like, put a black, like I have $600. Who has a T2? Like, that's all I have. Because they're just like $800 up again. So, but yeah, anyway.
Well, that's better than the $1,750 to $2,500 that I saw them for 6 months ago.
Yeah, it's wild. Like, I forget what I was watching. Oh, it was that Matt Day, Willem Verbeek thing that was going around. That guy at that camera store is like, I got this black tee, whatever. He's like $3,000. And I'm like, what? Oh my God. All right. I see you. But yeah, you can catch them between like $600 and $700 if you just wait for it.
Yeah.
You know?
Patience is a virtue when it comes to that, for sure.
I mean, I'm not one to sit there and say, I'll wait. I'm so sporadic and irrational when it comes to buying cameras.
Well, it's the same with a lot of things too. Like it also depends on where you're willing to look. Like, eBay sellers are savvy enough usually that they'll look at what the going rate is for completed auctions. And so even if they know nothing about cameras, they price.
Yeah.
They'll price something where they see it being bought. And if that is what people are paying for it, then fair enough to them. But if you go off the beaten track and you find some of the local shops that happen to have their stock listed online, but no one knows they exist. You can you can find some good deals, or like when I get to travel and I find any of those antique malls or charity shops or anything like that, I always look because you never know what you're going to find. And I think you've had Linus on the show, haven't you?
Yeah.
So yep. Linus and I are good friends, and he, you know, just this past weekend, he was in Tennessee making some videos and stopped in an antique mall and found two Nimslows and an Ishika I think he found those on Facebook Marketplace, but like, again, locally, it was just someone selling three D cameras for less than you'd buy one of them for. And he was in an antique mall and found an Nikon F2. For like $15. And
yeah, I saw that. Unreal. Right?
And again, it's so the deals are out there because the only reason the prices are inflated is for the market who knows they want one.
Exactly.
Anyway, we don't know. I'm sure that's enough talking about the financial market of used camera sales for one episode.
Yeah, we probably just bumped the prices up on these cameras again.
But there are cameras I try really hard to bite my tongue about when someone says, hey, what's your favorite whatever? I have to go, should I even
say that?
It is wonderful, but it might bump the price up, because I've done that before, and friends of mine have seen that effect before. I'm good friends with George Muncy as well, who runs Negative Feedback.
Yes, mm-hmm, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, we would all make fun of him for that effect years ago when the first year or two of the channel, especially, he'd talk about a camera and immediately the market would leap. Immediately.
That's crazy.
You knew it wasn't by chance. You knew it was like his video launched and within two or three days, like, the prices had doubled.
Should make a graph of like the upticks from his videos. Yes. From camera prices.
If he'd started a camera shop before, like in the early days of that, he could have totally done a bunch of insider trading. But that's
such a smart idea.
I don't think he's ever benefited once from that effect of increasing the cost of cameras. So, it happens.
That's great that you mentioned him. How did you guys get linked up, and how did you star in so many of those wonderful videos?
Yeah.
Well, in the early days of Negative Feedback, I think the way George told me the story was that the inspiration originally for Negative Feedback came from one or two photo walks that he and I and a couple other people who were mutual friends had just gone on around London. Because, I mean, there's a massive age difference between us, but my creative circles in London span like a good 20 years worth of people who are just all creative and doing all the same stuff. Yeah, there's very little age barriers that I've seen in that London or in my corner of the London crew, at least. Not just in photography, but photography design and cinematography and filmmaking. And so I was actually a guest on a podcast that a now friend of mine, Harry Hitchens, was running. He ran two seasons of this podcast called Filler. And this is going back 5-6 years, probably five and a half years at least. And I was on an episode of that. And George was a friend of Harry's. And George was doing the behind the scenes photos while they were recording the podcast, because it was in person in London. And that was it. And like after we'd recorded that podcast, I had my film camera with me and Harry had one of his. And so we just like went for a walk afterwards because it was a nice day. And the chats that happened through that, and then another one that we'd kind of gotten together with a few other people on a separate day to do, that's what kind of inspired Negative Feedback to begin with, was this idea of like just film being this casual thing and a conversation. So if you look back at all of his original episodes, George always had someone else along with him to talk about a camera or a film or something else. And that was the whole thing. It was just a conversation. And it was a conversation between friends about film photography. And I think that's also what made it such a big hit in the beginning, is that it wasn't about,
man, I love that,
really about gear. The gear or the film or the technique was just the excuse for getting together and having some fun and having a chat.
It's the best.
Yeah. And so I think the first episode that I was actually on after was back in the late fall 2016. And it was just by chance. I'd just come back from San Francisco. I'd been out there for the iPhone 7 launch because I'd been doing some work with Apple. And George kind of messaged me and said, Louis and I are going to film an episode I think he was either saying today, and I got like no,
that's awesome,
or it was going to be the next day, but I think it was that day. And he's, you know, we're going to do some low light, you know, photography pushing black and white film. And at that point, I had never pushed film before. I knew about it, but I'd never gotten to that point of experimenting with it, which is funny now because like I push black and white film as a rule, and I push color film. I even push slide film now. Like I'm all in on manipulations, but, and again, sometimes you just need an excuse and otherwise you don't try a new thing. And so I said yes. And I just bought a new camera, while I was in San Francisco, found one that I'd had on my list for a couple of years and found a good deal on it. I needed a lens for it. So like I said, yeah, but before we start filming, we just have to run to this camera shop so I can buy a lens. I've found they have one. It's a good price. And that's literally the beginning of the video is us. I think it's as I'm loading film in that camera shop, maybe.
Oh, cool.
Because I also had to buy a strap for it. Like it was one of those things where it was just slapped together. And we had so much fun. I've still some of those shots that I took that night, because we pushed HP5 and we pushed JCH400, Japan Camera Hunters film. And that was the first one. And then we just had so much fun that we did a couple more on various topics. So that, yeah, it was just, I love doing stuff like that. And the thing with me is that I'm always willing to say yes. A lot of people are, I think, get nervous at the idea of being on camera. And I've not spent a ton of my life on camera, but I've spent a lot more of it than most people have.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in the last 5, 6, 7 years. Whether it's for clients or doing hosting events or doing promotional videos or Skillshare classes, whatever it happens to be. But I've also been on stage as a singer since I was about 12. So that's really the thing that I've been a public speaker in the design community since 2006 or seven. And I've spent probably 30 years of my life on stage in front of audiences. So the idea of doing that, I'm not afraid of making a fool of myself, basically. It's like, I know I'm probably going to, and that, as long as you're okay with that, you can just leap at stuff and say, yeah, yeah, sure, I'll do that. Oh, you need someone to help you out the last minute? Yeah, no problem. Let me do that. And so, yeah, no, that kind of stuff is, it's been a lot of fun for me. And I even got last October, I was up in New York for PPE, Photo Plus Expo. And I was doing a couple of things with Ilford while I was there. And then, and I've been talking with the folks at Intrepid Camera about a few things, because
I love those guys.
Yeah, they're a great team. And I've been a fan of their cameras and what they're doing to introduce people to large format. And so I knew they were going to be there, and I was like, oh, great. You know, we haven't been able to meet in person, even though I'm in London and you're in Brighton, like let's meet in New York. And at the last minute, they kind of said, oh, hey, what do you think about doing a video with Willem? We're going to do like this, the first episode of this Peel Pals, where we shoot, you know, Fuji FP100 film on our cameras. And I said, yeah, sure. So it's the, you know, we threw together something on Roosevelt Island, and it was brilliant. It was a lot of fun. And, you know, it felt a lot more like those early negative feedback videos where it wasn't really planned. It wasn't too coordinated. The idea is just for it to be light and not super serious.
That being said, do you have any plans to start your own little YouTube channel?
People have been asking me that for years, and I don't.
I'm sure. YouTube's time consuming, so.
Well,
you know.
That's the thing. I mean, anything good is time consuming. And I have my fingers in a lot of different pies already, between physical products that I'm working on, you know, collaborations with other makers, design work that I'm doing on my own products primarily, but then also client work and lots of teaching. Well, prior to this whole pandemic thing, I had such a full schedule this year. Through the late summer with a new workshop series that I was starting, some travel series that I was kicking off, and physical products that we're going to be launching and other things. So it's just one of those things that I've known that I haven't had time to do YouTube the way that I want to do YouTube. And I think the thing is I've got a couple of different series ideas in my mind for years, but they would require a lot of time, and not just a lot of time. They would require a budget to do.
Yeah.
And that turns it into a different prospect. And I don't want to do that. The reason is I don't want to do what anyone else is doing, but I don't want to do anything that's even close to what anyone else in the space is doing. Cause it would be around photography. I wouldn't do kind of a YouTube on design, I don't think, but yeah. So maybe
that
one
could be
day,
cool.
Maybe one day, but honestly, like I'm putting so much of my time into trying to do filmmaking that's on a different scale, away, not in the YouTube area, you know, first starting with documentary work and also kind of slowly working on ideas for short narrative films. And that is super, super time consuming even before you start filming. And yeah. So there's just only so many hours. So I think I'm for the time being, I'm happier to, just like with a podcast, like I would love to run a podcast. I ran a part-time kind of podcast 12, 13 years ago with a buddy of mine in California. And that was when no one was doing podcasts.
Yeah.
And it was super time consuming back then. And I just think, you know what, I'd rather be, I think for YouTube and podcasting, if I can be a guest and contribute to conversations or every once in a while I've been like a guest host for some.
Oh, that's cool. That's a good idea.
And I love doing that. I love doing that as well. And it allows me to feel like I'm part of that, these various movements, but I don't have to, you know, for me, I don't have to own the thing. I like participating. And if I can be of help to people, then that ticks enough boxes for me. So yeah, I'll leave YouTube to the people who are killing it on YouTube.
So you said you had all this stuff lined up before the COVID epidemic hit. What have you been doing to fill your time since you've just been kind of sitting in Florida?
Well, amazingly, I feel like I've somehow been busier than I would have been otherwise, which isn't actually true. It's just the fact that, you know, our brains are in this weird pandemic mindset where things fill up our brain much more quickly, I think. But the first 2 weeks were, because I got stuck here, I was on a family visit for 2 weeks. And the day I was scheduled to fly out, I kind of realized that all of my plans for the next few months were probably going to get canceled. And I kind of went, let me just move my flight back to London and cancel a couple of flights and trains for the next few weeks. Because those events aren't happening. Because I was going to be flying to London. I was there for not even a day. I was going to go straight to the photography show in Birmingham, run a photo walk there, and then speak the next day, and then fly to Iceland for another conference. Like, I was just boom, 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 like all over the place. And I pulled the plug on it rather than have things canceled on me. And within 2 weeks, everything had actually been canceled, and it was very clear that nothing was going to happen. But so I was here for 2 weeks, and I thought I'd be able to go back. I didn't have much stuff with me. I certainly wasn't prepared to, I mean, I've been here 3 months now, just over 3 months. I've been stuck here 3 months. And so the first couple of weeks, I didn't know how long I'd be here. So I kind of said, okay, well, I've been just traveling nonstop for months and months and months. And there are a lot of things that I've wanted to start doing that need time in one place. So, and one of those things was starting to do home developing, which I've developed a handful of roles over the years, but never, like, I've been just on the go so much that it's been impractical to have my own setup. And so I thought, okay, well, this has been on my list and I was going to be starting it in a few months anyway. So why don't I just do it now? Yeah. And so I placed a massive order with B&H and just ordered a bunch of different chemicals and bottles and things. And so I started doing that and getting into camera scanning, which has actually been, the two of those things have taken up quite a bit of my time because I've been also kind of, my design teacher brain has been looking at all of the instructions that are out there for things, everything from the camera scanning and its setup and conversions. Once you get that scan into digital and developing and processing and just finding little, I've basically been doing copy editing for all the instructions that I find for all this stuff, seeing why are all these things just slightly inconsistent everywhere? If I was a beginner who had no understanding of it, I would feel very lost because I feel kind of lost and I know what all this stuff is. And so I've kind of taken on these side projects of putting together, like trying to compile all the right information and see if there's a way that I can work with the companies that are putting a lot of this stuff out and say, hey, can we just kind of align this a little bit more so it's not as confusing for people? And that's been kind of fun because that's my product design brain. I'm in the process of starting a couple of companies in design and to do things that basically you need just time to work on while all the other stuff is on hold. And I've been I feel like I've been doing a lot of stuff. I've been inching forward a lot of projects that were product design related that were already underway but have just like they're going through molasses right now. And I'm investigating a lot of just a lot of little tiny new things. So some of them are just for fun. Like I can't send any of my cameras out for service while I'm stuck here. So I've been working with my main service tech in the UK, Piero, who runs PPP Repairs, and he's excellent.
Okay, yeah,
a lot of
he's
quickly become one of the most used in Europe, and he and I are starting to work together properly, like officially this summer. I'm going to start being kind of creative director for PPP going forward. We've got products that we're designing for photographers, for people who have old film cameras, and got all sorts of interesting things coming up on there. But so I've also set up a little workshop here for with his advice, kind of saying, okay, what tools do I need to like dismantle a lens and clean some fungus off? And like, how do I replace, I've done light seals, so that's easy, but how do I do a CLA on my M6? You know, it's
man.
So yeah. And all of those things, plus just stuff. Cause I'm here, I'm staying with my mom, and this is the longest period of time that I've been staying with family since I left home. So it's a really long time. So I've also been doing lots of projects around the house, and I've been spending time with my mom and my brother and his family, because I've got two nieces and a nephew, and they live 15 minutes away. So yeah, the time just ends up being filled.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all, yeah, somehow I've managed to feel like I'm busier. As I said, I have my fingers in a lot of pies, and I think I've managed to have more pies. And I haven't I haven't even gotten to baking sourdough yet.
So. Yeah.
That's your like creative brain though. Like I feel like a lot of us creatives are like, okay, cool, idle time. Well, let's do these things I've never gotten a chance to do before. Yeah, yeah. So that's like really cool.
Well, I think a lot of people have responded to the extra time on their hands in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's different. You know, I work for myself, so I've spent my life doing that. I started working for myself at 16, and my brother and I ran a creative agency for about 15 years as well. But so my entire work experience is made up of having to do everything myself. So I don't, I'm very bad at sitting around waiting for people to come and ask me to do something. If they do, then I say yes. But but I'm also generating stuff for myself. So, I mean, I've also been working with a charity. I mean, I nearly completely forgot. It's like, I've been doing this stuff with this charity, 100 Cameras in New York. I've been working with them a lot on some things these last couple of months. And we've got a big workshop that we're doing this week for an outside organization. So there's like loads of stuff. And I'm, as I said, I say yes. I'm the first person to say yes to stuff. And I've still been doing little bits of music, because my quartet is, even though we can't be like meet up together physically, because the other two guys are up in, I sing with my brother. He's one of the four. And then the other two guys are up in Hershey, Pennsylvania. And we're working on figuring out how we can record a virtual album, because we've got the tech for it.
I was just
going
to ask.
Yeah.
Where can we download your stuff?
Well, there is stuff. You'll be able to find stuff on YouTube if you look for it. There are like live performances and stuff. So we're going to try to, if you look up, if anyone wants to hear, I don't really spread it around, because it's like, for me, it's like this separate life that has nothing to do with the photographic or design life. But the current quartet's name is Throwback. And it's actually been around for about 10 years now, in a couple of different formations. And there are videos on YouTube, and they're all live performances. And so the audio is not always the best, but it's a really good sense of what that kind of thing looks like. It's a barbershop quartet, right? But
that's amazing.
In a modern form. And it's just another one of my lives that I live.
Dan, I wanted to take you back a little bit. I read that you were like an early adopter to Instagram. Is that true? What's the story with the beginning of Instagram and you?
That again, roundabout story that ties into photography and why I was able to start.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Start working as a commercial photographer, but the way I came to Instagram was because of my reputation as a designer. I was in the very earliest days of the iPhone supporting apps. I was getting asked by app designers and developers to kind of beta test their apps and give them feedback on the interfaces. And some of them would be actual clients who would engage me to do that. And but other times it would just be apps that I thought were interesting. And then I'd, you know, they'd say, oh, yeah, we'd love if you'd kick the tires on this. And Instagram kind of happened that way, where a good friend of mine who was at the time was a designer at Harvard. He was already beta testing Instagram, but I don't even think it was called Instagram at that point yet.
Wow, in the interesting. Beta.
It was before, interesting, this was before it was released. And he tweeted, because I'm an early adopter for everything. So I've been on Twitter since 2006, right? Like its first year. And Twitter is great for discovery for those kind of things. And he tweeted the icon, which back then was like a front-on Polaroid, like the white plastic.
Yeah, I remember that.
SX70. And he tweeted, and I knew what the camera was because by that point I was a camera geek. And he said, he tweeted the icon and said something like cryptic, like playing with something really fun. And I just replied to him and said, I don't know what it is, but I need to be in on it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He, at that time, I was the guy in my design circles especially at conferences around the US, I was the guy that people would ask for advice on photography, because by that point I was 2 or 3 years in and I was really reverse engineering the whole process. I was learning everything I could about the physics of light and about the way cameras worked. And so designers who were playing around with cameras would ask me, because it would be like, oh, Dan knows, ask him. So yeah. Patrick, my buddy at Harvard, he messaged Kevin and Mike, who were at that time, like, they were the founders of Instagram, but it was just them. And he said, oh, you should really invite Dan. Like, he actually knows what he's doing with photography. And that's how I got on the beta. And it was maybe a month and a half or 2 months before it launched publicly. So, I mean, it's coming up this, I think August or September. Yeah, August will be 10 years since that happened, which is insane. Wow. And of course, when it launched, I ended up being one of a very small number of people who were already on the platform. There were like 30 or 40 people maybe by the time it launched.
So crazy.
And my work was actually featured on the iTunes banner in the iTunes store when it launched. And it was just by chance, but because I was already traveling, I was traveling the world already for design conferences, and I was kind of part-time living in the UK by then as well. So my Instagram feed was already a travel photography feed, even though it wasn't that good. It was better than a lot of the rest. And then things just snowballed from there, because all that attention started to get focused on this new platform. And I was one of a few people who would get recommended to others and whose work was kind of better than some of the others who were just beta testers from the tech industry. And it was a lot of dumb luck was involved with everything that came afterwards.
That's great.
Yeah. But it's such a strange thing to look back on, because none of the connections that I made that allowed me to become a photographer who got paid to take pictures would have happened in the way they did or in the time scale that they did if not for Instagram and all the attention that I got because of that. And I mean, that just shows you how ludicrous life can be sometimes, because there are people I know who are so immensely talented and no one knows about. And talent has nothing to do with it. I keep telling people that. I mean, you've got to be talented to be able to do the work. Right. But talent does not mean that you'll get discovered in any kind of way. Mm-hmm. And you almost can't control being discovered and noticed. It's you've just got to be ready for when an opportunity comes along that allows you to convert that opportunity into something else. And you also have to know what it is that you want to convert that into. Like, I already knew before Instagram became a thing, I was loving photography so much as a hobby that I was telling people that, like, in 3 to 5 years, I wanted to be making part of my income from it. And they would ask me, oh, well, how? And I said, I don't know how, but it's like 3 to 5 years. Like, a lot can happen in 3 to 5 years. And in that time frame was when Instagram became a thing. And that time frame worked for me. But it was only because I knew that I wanted that to be something before the opportunity came up. Mm-hmm. And so when the opportunity came up, I was ready to go, oop, this is it. This is the brass ring that I have to grab onto.
And it's crazy to think, like, if you weren't on Twitter at that time and like had scrolled by and didn't notice, you know. It's just like stuff like that is so crazy to me.
You know the movie Sliding Doors, right?
No.
Gwen Paltrow and I forget who else was in it. It's a Gwen Paltrow film, and it's I think about it all the time because it's a go watch Sliding Doors.
Yeah,
it's a wonderful film. It's a little heartbreaking, but it's wonderful, and it's all about those moments in life that mm-hmm. we never know. We never realize that there's like a fork that where we could have gone the other way and our life would have been completely different, but they happen all the time. And when you get a chance to look back and like you said, when you get that opportunity to go, wow, if I hadn't seen Patrick's tweet, mm-hmm. if I hadn't gone Twitter in 2006,
yeah,
like 4 years previously. Right.
Wow.
If I hadn't, there are so many ifs that, as I said, it's ludicrous. It's just the fact that I'm sitting here chatting with you is because I decided to get on Twitter in October or November of 2006, right? Like that's the connection that runs all the way back to that in a way. And, you know, that's the thing with hindsight. It all makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost never makes sense at the time because we can't predict what's going to come of something, but it's why we always have to be just open to whatever might come our way. And I try to teach people that as much as I can, because that's really the only reason that I've done anything I've done in my life, is that I've been open to things and I'm willing to explore and make mistakes and maybe have something not be for me. But I rarely discount something before trying it.
I like the idea of, you said you're like, you always say yes. And I've tried to adapt that in my life, because you know, we can always be like, oh, I don't know. Not me. I don't know. But now you just got to be like, yeah, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we'll see and figure it out, because one thing leads to one thing. And like you said, like,
exactly.
Boom, boom, boom. And here we are now. We're glad you're here with us, Dan. That's for sure.
Well, and even a lot of stuff like, I was just thinking, like I pulled out a couple of things just to sit next to me in case they came up. But, a combination of the, you know, what have you been doing during the pandemic, like this, like isolation of not being able to travel and not being able to do other things, but also what we're just talking about being open to trying new things that maybe I wasn't thinking about before. They don't have to be big things, but like I'd never considered bulk loading my film before.
I still have it.
It's like, I just, well, I, whenever I'd heard people talking about it, I thought, oh, that's, why would you do that? That seems like a pain in the ass. Like it's just, I just want to buy the film and put it in my camera. And I mean, I understood the economics of it, but I was like, yeah, but it's going to be time consuming and then you've got to, whatever. It just seemed like too much of a fuss. And especially on my pace and traveling the way I was. So, but being stuck here, I just happened to see a friend's Instagram story where he was like bulk loading, and I didn't know he bulk loaded. My friend Jahan he runs Do You Develop. It's fantastic black and white photographer, among other things. And I didn't know he bulk loaded, and we were going to be starting running a series of travel 4x5 workshops this year. Right. And for some reason, bulk loading 35 mil had just never come up in our discussions. And so he was like, oh yeah, it's great. And he told me about it. And I, like that day I found this old version of the loader on eBay, bought like a tin of Fomapan and now I'm geeking out over, I'm like, oh cool, I can load like a 10 exposure roll and like practice pulling or pushing weird way. Or
yeah. That's the benefit right there.
And just the fact that I was like, well, I have the time now. So anything that I have the time for and the space for now, I may as well say yes to, even if I was saying no to it before. And so that, I think that's another critical part of it, is that no matter how open you are, we all make judgments that, even if they're snap judgments of going, I don't have time to do this right now. And then we block it out and we forget about it. So being willing to change your mind on things mm-hmm. and go, I was closed to that before, but I'm going to be open to it now. Even that can be a super powerful thing. And I think have to be, if you're a creative person, you have to know where your lines are to mm-hmm. to format your own voice and your own view of things. But you also have to be willing to accept when that voice might need recalibrating.
Oh, man. Yes.
So true.
It's such it's tragic as this time has been mm-hmm. for everyone. I think it was well needed especially like I was working a full-time job for the last, like same place for the last 8 years. I needed this like 3 month break from being at this place every day and giving myself a chance to say yes to things or explore things that I've wanted to get into and just haven't had the time or the desire because, you know, working really wears you out sometimes. So
yeah,
but having this time was well needed, and it completely changed my outlook on things. Like, I hope my boss isn't listening, but you know, I'm probably not going back there. So it's just crazy, like how just a little bit of time like that, if you give yourself some space to spread your wings and just kind of learn new things, and I don't know, it's really good. I'm glad we touched on this topic today.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with a listener question for Dan right after this message from our sponsor.
Support for Analog Talk comes from Polaroid. Use the promo code ANALOGTALK10 on your first purchase on film at Polaroid.com.
All right, guys, this is part of the show where we break off and take a question from one of our listeners. And this week's question comes from Skalkoff. And they wanted to know, what's your end goal? At the end of your life, what would you like to have achieved with your photography? Deep.
It's such a heavy question. I mean, it can get heavier, right? Like, we have no idea when the end is going to be, right?
Exactly.
So, which I know is going really dark as a way to start the answer, but that's one of the things that I kind of think about with every creative decision that I make and every change of direction that I make in my life as a creative. Is it's got to be playing for me into, you know, a mixture of a short-term gain, because, you know, if I kind of want to experiment and see where something's going, then it's in the short term. And it's only after that experimentation that I understand whether it can play into something bigger that can be long-term. And the long-term, you never really have a really good handle on it, other than generic things like, as a designer, I want to make the world a better place. But that's like... You know, so at the end, you know, if someone wants to write something on my tombstone about how I was a designer, I hope they say something about, you know, he made the world a better place, right? He left it better than he found it. But even that, to me, that's not a goal you work towards, because that's not a very, like, of course, as a designer, you want to make things better. So it's not specific enough. And with photography, it's kind of the same for me, because I want to make some sort of impact, but I don't know what that impact is yet. Because I get pulled as a photographer in so many different ways. You know, I really love documenting things. I love doing behind the scenes work for filmmaker friends of mine. I think that's just, it's just amazing to kind of capture work in progress when something else, other type of art is being made, especially. But I also like properly documentary work, and I'm working on doing more of that myself, because that feels like it has meaning. And whatever meaning is still a kind of a fuzzy definition, but I think for me, everything that I do has to mean something to other people as well as to me. I'm very driven by external motivation, and I've been that way even when I was a competitive swimmer in my teens. Like, I showed up to practice because I didn't want to let my coach down, not because I loved swimming that much that I was addicted to it, right? I stopped competitive swimming when my coach left the team. It was like, all right, fine, don't need to do this anymore. So I know that I'm very extrinsically motivated, and with art is something that I'm still getting into, because I've been a functional creative for most of my life. What I mean by that is like very purpose driven, solving problems for other people. So as a designer, I've been mostly working for clients. So that's very different than art, where I'm even when you're commissioned as an artist, you're commissioned to do your own thing. When you're commissioned as a designer, you're commissioned to solve someone else's problem. Someone else has identified that problem, or they've mostly identified the problem. They want you to identify the specifics and then come up with a solution. And as a musician, I've been very much in the same way as well. I'm not a composer. I'm not an arranger. I take other people's compositions or arrangements, and then I'm either a director of a chorus, and I help interpret that and teach the chorus how to sing it and how to convey emotions through it. But I haven't created the artwork. I'm creating a representation of someone else's artwork. And so I've seen much of my photography career has been kind of at least half of that, where it's because I don't have a fully established style visually. That in an artistic way, I art direct as a designer, where I'll say, what is the most appropriate solution for this brand's problem? What does this brand's work look like? Okay, I'll adjust my photographic style to match that brand's look. And that's not how a lot of photographers work. And the agents that I've been represented by for the last few years they get incredibly frustrated by that because I'm very hard to sell in that way. So I'm kind of in this place still, you know, again, 12, 13 years after picking up a camera, but probably 7 years after starting to do commercial photography work, where I'm still working out what is it that I'm trying to put out there. I know what I'm getting from it, but I could very happily be a photographer and never look at my pictures, because the thing that I personally get out of photography the most is hunting for the picture and up to the moment where I've captured it. And it's like I've gone 3-4 months sometimes without developing film, or I've just got like a bag of stuff and people are like, can't you wait to see it? I'm like, no, I know the shots I got. I'll see them. I'll be really happy with them. But it's such a separate part of that process for me. And so because that's where it stops for me, I'm more interested in getting pictures developed and printed to show other people and for other people to like, which is a weird relationship that I don't like. But it's very similar, I guess, to the music for me. Because I don't compose music, my entire musical life has been preparing music for performance. So it doesn't exist. I don't exist as a musician without an audience. Like there would be no point for the type of music that I do without having an audience to prepare for and perform for. And so my photography has been very much like that in a way. And I've been spending a lot of my thinking time and my research time in the last 3-4 years, especially figuring out what that next step's going to be. And this does play into answering this question, because what I want that without having an answer to what my next step is going to be, I can't answer this listener's question, which is, but I know I have to, because what I want is to be able to have some sort of impact with my photography. And whether that means, I don't actually mind what it is, to be honest, as long as it's a positive impact, as long as it's, so if that ends up being that I do a lot of documentary work and that helps tell stories that wouldn't have been told otherwise, that would be sufficient. If my photography somehow ends up inspiring other people to take up photography or to do something that someone else hadn't done or had never suggested to them before, then that would be sufficient. And the likelihood is it'll be a combination of those things. But I kind of think a lot of the time I hear other photographers get asked about, like, what do you want your legacy to be, right? That particular word, legacy. And that always strikes me as a bit strange, because I don't think if you look at Cartier-Bresson's legacy and then you read everything Cartier-Bresson wrote or said in an interview, it doesn't seem like he wasn't working toward the legacy he's left. Yeah. He was doing something. His mission was very different than his legacy. Mm. The legacy is what other people see as a result of what it is that you're putting out into something. And it's like no one on earth should ever call themselves a visionary, right? Someone else, after you do something really cool and amazing, then other people get to call you a visionary, but it doesn't work the other way around. So it would be like asking someone, you know, like, what do you want to be known as a visionary for? It's like, what? What? It's just a bit weird. So none of this, to wrap this up, I mean, I'm not saying this to dodge the question. I want there to be an impact, but at the end of everything, I just want there to have been meaningful output from it, whatever shape that takes, because the meaning in it will be for other people, not for me. The meaning that I get out of doing it, as long as I'm doing it, I will be getting everything that I need out of it, or I will be working toward figuring out whatever that next thing is that I need. And for me, that's going to be a constant iteration. I'm never going to be happy with what I've done. I'm always going to be kind of trying to push on to something new and something interesting. But that process is kind of what I love the most about the creative process, is the being in it. Once you're done with it, it's kind of boring. You've got to go to the next thing. I hate finishing projects.
Oh, like, same. I don't get, it's like a drug. Same here.
Yeah, I don't get any kind of feeling of relief when a project is done. I get this kind of feeling of emptiness. So I there are ways with a lot of my personal projects, I try to avoid finishing them, which is horrible. But because I kind of, it's like a good book. It's like if you get a really good novel and you know that you're coming closer to the end of it, like, I tend to slow down in my reading because I just don't want to let those characters go. I don't want to leave that world just yet. I hope that gives some sort of answer in the toward that question, but it's a great question, just super, super deep.
Yeah. I think that's super relatable answer too. I think a lot of us 100% can relate to.
And then Ektachrome. Sorry, Kodachrome. I made the same mistake. Do I think Kodak should bring back? So I've had a lot of conversations about this, even with some folks at Kodak. And because it's a funny thing, right? All you have to do is Google to see Kodak's official response 16 times on this. And it's that, like, they can't make it. If you question that, then you just need to Google a little bit more to find the results that tell you why they discontinued it in the first place. And you go, oh, yeah, they can't make these chemicals anymore. Like, this was a horrible process. It was horrible for the environment, right? Great result, really, really bad for the earth. It's people keep asking the question. And I know I've got friends at Kodak, and they get this question more than they get any other question.
I believe it.
That's crazy.
But the reason is because Kodachrome looked like nothing else. And so here's another fear of missing out. So before I really knew what I was doing with cameras, but I was 2 years, I guess, into playing. It was the summer of 2009. So 2009 was the last year that Kodachrome was being processed by what was their name? They were in the States.
Dale's camera
Dale.
Or something
yeah,
like that?
I think it was Dale's or something like that. And they were in like Kentucky or Kansas City or something. I think it was Kansas City. And again, like with the Polaroid, by that point, I was a couple of years in, I was playing with a lot of different cameras, and I saw this news that they were discontinuing it. And this is like the last roll would be processed near the end of that year. And I said, I need to buy a roll or two and shoot it. Just, I have no idea what I'm doing, but I want to be able to say I did this. And so I bought two rolls. I think I shot one of them and left the other one unopened. And I shot this
souvenir
during a summer. Exactly. And I shot it during a summer in the UK that I spent in the UK in 2009 on a camera that I found there. I'd taken a bunch of like a weird mix of cameras along with me. But this just shows how like open to experimentation I was, but also how far away I was from understanding anything. Because what I should have done, I had my dad's old Nikon F. I should have just shot it on that, because that would have been brilliant results. But instead, I found a Voigtlander Vitessa T, which is a gorgeous camera with a plunger to wind.
I've seen that guy. Yes.
I found it cheap in a charity shop for a fraction of what it should have cost. It was in beautiful condition. It looks like something Johnny Ive would have designed for Apple. It's just got the most beautiful milled corners. And I thought, yeah, sure. This untested camera with a selenium meter, which I didn't know what it was back then, right? I didn't know how unreliable it was. I was like, I'll put my roll of Kodachrome through that. And very luckily, the meter worked. The pictures all turned out
pretty good.
Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't know what I was doing with any of this. I didn't know how to, it shows how resilient those cameras are, but also how great Kodachrome was that I got exposures that looked decent out of that roll. And even that role, like those colors are just gorgeous. And some of my inspiration for color work is like the 4x5 Kodachrome work from the 1940s, from like the wartime press shots, which are just stunning. And you can find that they're all available on either Flickr or other sources, because they're all open, available to the public. Because they're government, U.S. government images. Yeah. They're wonderful resources. And when Ektachrome was renewed, again, long answers. I told you I could fill up an hour with anything. When Ektachrome was re-released, one of the things that I wanted to do was see how different the colors were from the Ektachrome that I'd shot a little bit of, and also like whether it was closer to or further away from Kodachrome. Because it's like a lot of the reds and skin tones are it's the reds that Kodachrome really makes look a certain way. But it's also the fact that a lot of Kodachrome wasn't seen as the slide, and it wasn't seen as a scan. Kodachrome was seen once it was converted to a CMYK print process, which was a lot narrower color palette, a smaller gamut. And then it was printed in halftone on paper. So we have this weird, not quite realistic idea of what Kodachrome looks like. And so I started messing around with Ektachrome. I guess I shot my first couple of rolls a year and a half ago in 35mm in Copenhagen for New Year's, and I metered them horribly. Like my mistake for it. Like I was mostly shooting negative film. I hadn't shot slide film really that much, and like occasional rolls. But I put it in my camera, and I just metered most of it, metering for shadows like I normally would. I just wasn't thinking, and so a few exposures came out okay, but the rest of it wasn't. I was just like, man. And I left it alone for a few months, and then in the summer I went to an exhibition in Brooklyn of Gary Winogrand's work, which is, again, stunning work from the 60s and 70s. And his color work is, it was an exhibition of his color work, and it was fantastic. But in the very first part of that exhibition, there was an old Kodak slide machine that they had loaded with his original slides,
projecting
them,
which you never get to see, right? And I'm looking at these slides from the 70s going, there's just a bulb behind these. There's no editing. There's no curve being applied. These are the slides. And they look like super contrasty and really punchy. Like they look in a way that none of my slides had ever looked. And that started me on this journey. So I mentioned earlier, I like pushing slide film now. And the next day after seeing that Winogrand exhibition, I put a roll of Provia, which is just what I happened to have with me on that trip. I put some Provia 100F in my camera and decided I was going to push it one stop and meter only for highlights. And I said, you know what, because I'd looked at these pictures of Winogrand's and I went, he's shooting these handheld in really contrasty light. There's no shadow detail. He at least exposed for highlights, but they're so punchy and they weren't Kodachrome. They were like older Provia or Velvia or something. But I said, they're so contrasty that I think he might have done a slight push. And it connected a dot for me that I had never thought of, because I've never read about how, you don't read about how people processed the Kodachrome or their Provia or Ektachrome. You just read about what the film was. And the results from that roll blew me away. And I said, because they almost looked like slide film from the 60s or 70s.
Damn.
And all I'd done was underexpose and push. And I got more detail in the shadows from the push than I would have otherwise. And that kind of, that plus a conversation with my main lab in London about why that happened. They said, oh yeah, all the photographers 30 years ago, like they would all do a quarter stop push or a half stop push or a three quarter stop push. I'm like, wait, what? They would with their slide film. And they said, yeah, the same stuff would happen with Kodachrome. Like, no, they said, dude, people would do whatever they had to for the lighting that they had.
Yeah.
You know, if they had Kodachrome 64, they would shoot it as 200 if they didn't have any 200 left. I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to look at every picture I've ever seen before and look at it again.
Yeah.
And so I've started, I went and started doing the same experiments over the last, like, well, from July, June of last year. Like I was shooting and pushing slide film in all sorts of different ways and exposing it in different ways to try and get a different look. And all this is to say that with these experiments, what I started to see in certain lighting situations out of pushed ektachrome, the new ektachrome, was tones that started to shift closer to what you would feel you'd get out of some Kodachrome. And they're not identical, but I've actually got one of the projects that's been put on hold. And now I'm like, anyone who listens to this podcast will be able to like try this project as well, but it doesn't matter. Like I'm never precious about this stuff. It was an experiment and I'll still run it. But with a cinematographer friend of mine in London, who does some lighting for me, we've got this mood board of all these old 1940s 4x5 Kodachrome shots. And we've started to tone map, and we think we can actually get really close to reproducing them with the right lighting and the right tones in the image. So if we start to get like color, like the outfits and clothing that have the right color dyes, and you know, the same for, you know, we're going to look for kind of a color noir look to begin with and just say, let's see if we can, how close we can match this. But with him looking at it through his cinematographer lighting eye and me talking with my lab and knowing what my initial experiments have been, we've realized we can like a lot of how Kodachrome looked was its process, but it was also how it was exposed, what the lenses were doing, and what those older coatings were doing or not doing, and how they were developing, and then how they were printing, because a lot of those images aren't scans from the slide, they're scans of prints. And so for all those people who really love the look of Kodachrome and wish they'd been able to shoot it or shot it once and want it to come back, what I'd actually say is experiment more with ektachrome and don't take it at face value for how it can be exposed, how it can be metered, how it can be developed even, because there are, one of the things that this kind of experiment and thought and shooting and developing has taught me in the last year, I guess, is that there's a lot less experimentation on the chemical side of film photography now than there used to be as a rule, because people are just seeing something on YouTube saying, oh, great, Portra 400. Oh, I expose it at 320. Okay, great. And that's all they do with it.
Yeah.
Whereas like I push Portra 160. I love it at 160, but I love 160 pushed one stop because it shifts all the blues in a way that no other film stock does. And I tell that to people who've been shooting 160 for years, and they're like, you push it? And I'm like, I push, if you've never pushed Portra 800, right, which is one of my favorite film stocks, it's also the most expensive film stock, but Portra 800 at 1600, but metering at 8, so metering one stop over like we would do for a lot of negative films, it sings. It's so good already that one stop push doesn't actually make it ugly or contrast or anything else. What it allows is street photography at F11 at handheld speeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without really heavy grain. And you get a slight color shift, but actually not as much as you'd think. Portra 400 doesn't push well at all for me. It turns its shadows like muddy and brown. But unless you do these experiments for yourself, unless you try all of these things, we're missing out on one of the great benefits of shooting film, which is that it is chemistry. It is something you can mess with at the time of shooting and afterwards to get all sorts of different results. So, so the answer for the Kodachrome is I wish they'd bring it back. I know they can't, but what they are bringing back, we should just be happy for what they are bringing back and what they are making and experiment with it. And, Once I can meet up with my cinematographer in London again, we are going to be doing this test. And
I can't wait to see this.
Yeah.
Well, try it yourself.
Anyway, you're right.
There is what what you and all your listeners have learned today, which is what anyone else who's ever talked to me has learned, is that there is no short answer with Dan Rubin.
That's great.
That's the best part of a podcast. I love when we have guests on and they're just like, I might talk a little bit. Is that okay? It's like, no, please. Like, that is the point.
Well, I've had you for over an hour at this point, which is more than more than you bargained for. So
we're gonna hit you with one more question.
Well, there's two.
It's a two-parter. Yeah.
All right. So we call these the tough questions. So, all right. It's the old the first half of the camera question is the desert island question. You know, you can only take one.
What's your favorite?
What's your favorite? You know, and there is a lab on the island. There's probably even some Kodachrome on the island too. So
who knows? Yeah, out of your 50, which is the main.
I'm gonna break the rule, which is, you know, don't talk about the camera that that you don't want everyone else to buy. But I also had it set out here. This is the one I bought right before that first episode of Negative Feedback with George. It's the Leica Flex SL.
Oh, wow.
And it is it's my favorite mechanical SLR. And because it's mechanical, but it has these beautiful Leica R lenses. And in Leica terms, it costs next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a crime really, because they shouldn't cost more, but it shows how much more expensive all that M world is, where the rendering's the same, like the glass is the same. They've been designed by the same people. The optics are it all comes from the same place. And the SL, the Leica Flex SL, is essentially an M6, but an SLR. It's super well built, over engineered. It's fully mechanical. It has a shutter speed up to 1/2000th of a second, which is actually great. And the only thing the battery runs is the light meter. So if the battery dies, you still have a completely functional camera.
You're set.
So that's my answer there.
Yeah, that's a first for the show.
I was gonna say, I don't think we've ever seen that before. Yeah.
All right. So the second part of the question is the white whale. Is there anything out there that you just haven't had a chance to get your hands on that you've always wanted to shoot?
Well, yes, a whole load. My pause is like the long list of those of the answers coming through my head. So one that I'd really, really love to shoot, but I've almost intentionally avoided because I don't want to buy it because it's super expensive, and it's the Contax 645. Is just, I've held one once and I like quickly put it down because I was like, oh, this feels so good to hold. And I know
I owned it for a little while.
Oh, yeah? And you loved it.
I did. I loved it, but I bought it for shooting weddings. And then when I moved out to LA, I shifted more towards, like, on-set photography. So I wasn't using it. But, like, It's my like one I hate selling cameras because I've regretted that specific sale so much.
Yep.
But it's a beautiful camera, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just a stunning thing. I mean, I love 645, and my main 645 camera is a Pentax 645N, and honestly, it's beautiful and gorgeous, mm-hmm. and it takes amazing pictures.
Yeah.
I don't need anything that costs three or four times as much that takes the same
right.
format, yeah. but it is a beautiful yeah. machine. And I, and there would be a runner up would be there are a handful of 8x10 cameras that I would just love to own, and I came so close to owning a Deerdorf 8x10. And I passed on it because I already had one 8x10 and I was like, I barely shoot this. I literally do not need another 8x10. And in hindsight, I should have bought that and sold the Toyo that
sold
I had.
The other,
and
oh. just
because there's just something so glorious about a wooden Deerdorf.
Yes.
And at the same time, I tell myself the same thing I tell other people who go, oh yeah, I want to save up for a Leica. And I'm like, don't spend that money on film and developing. Like, the camera's not going to make you a better photographer, really. Like, right. It might make you enjoy it a little bit more and in a different way and unlock different things, but it's not going to replace practice. And so for me, it's the same thing. You know, an 8x10 camera is already an 8x10 camera. It shoots the same sheet film as any other 8x10 camera and the same lenses too. So, you know, yeah, there we go. And what was the other so that's the Desert Island and the White Whale. Were those the two?
That's the two.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Good.
Mm-hmm.
Great. I'm just surprised that it only took like 3 minutes for me to answer those two.
Oh, man.
Well, Dan, we so appreciate you taking the time to hang out with us and chat about all this. This has been amazing. Where can everybody check you out? On Instagram?
Instagram is the main destination. I'm also on Twitter as well, which there's the if any of your listeners haven't discovered photo Twitter, I mean, it's really like this subset of people who, especially film photography Twitter, it's like this wonderful community mm-hmm. who talk to each other a lot more than people talk to each other on Instagram. So, Twitter and Instagram, I'm Dan Rubin on both of them.
Awesome. Timothy, where are you at?
Guys, head over to Instagram. It's at Timothy Makeups. I also make some film photography related YouTube videos. Easiest way to find them is just go to the search bar, you know, type in Timothy Makeups. You'll find a bunch of stuff there. Chris, where are you?
So I am Chris B. Photo on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. We are Analog Talk Pod on Twitter, Analog Talk Podcast on Instagram, and we have a Facebook page and a group you can like and join. And share stuff there. So, yes. Dan, thank you. This is phenomenal.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast.
Definitely.
All right, guys. We'll see you next time.
Bye. First off, we want to thank Dan for coming on the show. As Chris said, definitely a bucket list moment. And so glad to have you for our 100th episode. It was an honor. Dan, just keep killing everything you do. Like, we love it. Guys, it's going to take us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. For even $1, a buck, you can get the show 2 days early on Mondays on our Patreon. For all the Patreons who already help support the show, guys, we appreciate you guys so, 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 so much. We also have a bunch of stuff over there. We're doing Patreon exclusive after shows, just Patreon specials in general, where we have these plans to get these former guests on. We're going to do like 2 guests at a time, and it's just going to be for you guys. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. And until next week, guys, we will see you soon. Later.